So here it is. You all use the XNet. It's no coincidence that the XNet was created right after the DHS took over the city. The people who did that are an organization devoted to personal liberty, who created the network to keep us safe from DHS spooks and enforcers. Hulu and I had worked this out in advance. We weren't going to cop to being behind it all, not to anyone. It was way too risky. Instead, we'd put it out that we were merely lieutenants in Mikey's army, acting to organize the local resistance. The XNet isn't pure, I said. It can be used by the other side just as readily as by us. We know that there are DHS spies who use it now. They use social engineering hacks to try to get us to reveal ourselves so that they can bust us. If the XNet is going to succeed, we need to figure out how to keep them from spying on us. We need a network within the network. I paused and let this sink in. Hulu had suggested that this might be a little heavy, learning that you're about to be brought into a revolutionary cell. Now, I'm not here to ask you to do anything active. You don't have to go out jamming or anything. You've been brought here because we know you're cool. We know you're trustworthy. It's that trustworthiness I want to get you to contribute tonight. Some of you will already be familiar with the web of trust and key signing parties, but for the rest of you, I'll run it down quickly. Which I did. Now, what I want from you tonight is to meet the people here and figure out how much you can trust them. We're going to help you generate key pairs and share them with each other. This part was tricky. Asking people to bring their own laptops wouldn't have worked out, but we still needed to do something hella complicated that wouldn't exactly work with paper and pencil. I held up a laptop Hulu and I had rebuilt the night before, from the ground up. I trust this machine. Every component in it was laid by our own hands. It's running a fresh out-of-the-box version of Paranoid Linux, booted off of the DVD. If there's a trustworthy computer left anywhere in the world, this might well be it. I've got a key generator loaded here. You come up here and give it some random input, mash the keys, wiggle the mouse, and it will use that as the seed to create a random public and private key for you, which it will display on the screen. You can take a picture of the private key with your phone and hit any key to make it go away forever. It's not stored on the disk at all. Then it will show you your public key. At that point, you call over all the people here you trust and who trust you, and they take a picture of the screen with you standing next to it, so they know whose key it is. When you get home, you have to convert the photos to keys. This is going to be a lot of work, I'm afraid, but you'll only have to do it once. You have to be super careful about typing these in. One mistake, and you're screwed. Luckily, we've got a way to tell if you've got it right. Beneath the key will be a much shorter number called the fingerprint. Once you've typed in the key, you can generate a fingerprint from it and compare it to the fingerprint. And if they match, you've got it right. They all boggled at me. Okay, so I'd ask them to do something pretty weird. It's true. But still. Chapter 11. Hulu stood up. This is where it starts, guys. This is how we know which side you're on. You might not be willing to take to the streets and get busted for your beliefs, but if you have beliefs, this will let us know it. This will create the web of trust that tells us who's in and who's out. If we're ever going to get our country back, we need to do this. We need to do something like this. Someone in the audience, it was Ange, had a hand up, holding a beer bottle. So, call me stupid, but I don't understand this at all. Why do you want us to do this? Hulu looked at me, and I looked back at him. It had all seemed so obvious when we were organizing it. The XNet isn't just a way to play free games. It's the last open communications network in America. It's the last way to communicate without being snooped on by the DHS. For it to work, we need to know that the person we're talking to isn't a snoop. That means that we need to know that the people we're sending messages to are the people we think they are. That's where you come in. You're all here because we trust you, I mean, really trust you. Trust you with our lives. Some of the people groaned. It sounded melodramatic and stupid. I got back to my feet. When the bombs went off, I said, and then something welled up in my chest. Something painful. When the bombs went off, there were four of us caught up by Market Street. For whatever reason, the DHS decided that made us suspicious. They put bags over our heads, put us on a ship and interrogated us for days. They humiliated us, played games with our minds. Then they let us go. All except one person, my best friend. He was with us when they picked us up. He'd been hurt and he needed medical care. He never came out again. They say they never saw him. They say that if we ever tell anyone about this, they'll arrest us and make us disappear. Forever. I was shaking. The shame. The goddamn shame. Holu had the light on me. Oh, Christ, I said. You people are the first ones I've told. If this story gets around, you can bet they'll know who leaked it. You can bet they'll come knocking on my door. I took some more deep breaths. That's why I volunteered on the X-Net. That's why my life, from now on, is about fighting the DHS. With every breath, every day, until we're free again. Any one of you could put me in jail now, if you wanted to. Ange put her hand up again. We're not going to rat on you, she said. No way. I know pretty much everyone here, and I can promise you that. I don't know how to know who to trust, but I know who not to trust. Old people. Our parents. Grown-ups. When they think of someone being spied on, they think of someone else. A bad guy. When they think of someone being caught and sent to a secret prison, it's someone else. It's someone brown. Someone young. Someone foreign. They forget what it's like to be our age. To be the object of suspicion all the time. How many times have you gotten on the bus and had every person on it give you a look like you'd been gargling turds and skinning puppies? What's worse, they're turning into adults younger and younger out there. Back in the day, they used to say never trust anyone over 30. I say, don't trust any bastard over 25. That got a laugh, and she laughed too. She was pretty. In a weird, horsey way, with a long face and a long jaw. I'm not really kidding, you know. I mean, think about it. Who elected these ass clowns? Who let them invade our city? Who voted to put the cameras in our classrooms and follow us around with creepy spyware chips in our transit passes and cars? It wasn't a 16-year-old. We may be dumb, we may be young, but we're not scum. I want that on a t-shirt, I said. It would be a good one, she said. We smiled at each other. Where do I go to get my keys, she said, and pulled out her phone. We'll do it over there in the secluded spot by the caves. I'll take you in there and set you up. Then you do your thing and take the machine around to your friends to get photos of your public key so they can sign it when they get home. I raised my voice. Oh, one more thing. Jesus, I can't believe I forgot this. Delete those photos once you've typed in the keys. The last thing we want is a Flickr stream full of pictures of all of us conspiring together. There was some good-natured, nervous chuckling. Then Holu turned out the light, and in the sudden darkness, I could see nothing. Gradually, my eyes adjusted, and I set off for the cave. Someone was walking behind me. Ange. I turned and smiled at her, and she smiled back, luminous teeth in the dark. Thanks for that, I said. You were great. You mean what you said about the bag on your head and everything? I meant it, I said. It happened. I never told anyone, but it happened. I thought about it for a moment. You know, with all the time that went by since, without saying anything, it started to feel like a bad dream. It was real, though. I stopped and climbed up into the cave. I'm glad I finally told people. Any longer and I might have started to doubt my own sanity. I set up the laptop on a dry bit of rock and booted it from the DVD with her watching. I'm going to reboot it for every person. This is a standard Paranoid Linux disk, though I guess you'd have to take my word for it.
Hell, she said. This is all about trust, right?
Yeah, I said. Trust. I retreated some distance as she ran the key generator, listening to her typing and mousing to create randomness, listening to the crash of the surf, listening to the party noises from over where the beer was. She stepped out of the cave, carrying the laptop. On it, in huge white luminous letters, were her public key and her fingerprint and email address. She held the screen up beside her face and waited while I got my phone out.
Cheese, she said.
I snapped her pic and dropped the camera back in my pocket. She wandered off to the revelers and let them each get pics of her and the screen. It was festive. Fun. She really had a lot of charisma. You didn't want to laugh at her. You just wanted to laugh with her. And hell, it was funny. We were declaring a secret war on the secret police. Who the hell did we think we were? So it went. Through the next hour or so, everyone taking pictures and making keys. I got to meet everyone there. I knew a lot of them. Some were my invitees, and the others were friends of my pals or my pals' pals. We should all be buddies. We were, by the time the night was out. They were all good people. Once everyone was done, Holu went to make a key, and then turned away, giving me a sheepish grin. I was past my anger with him, though. He was doing what he had to do. I knew that no matter what he said, he'd always be there for me. And we'd been through the DHS jail together. Van, too. No matter what, that would bind us together forever. I did my key and did the perp walk around the gang, letting everyone snap a pic. Then I climbed up on the high spot I'd spoken from earlier and called for everyone's attention. So a lot of you have noted that there's a vital flaw in this procedure. What if this laptop can't be trusted? What if it's secretly recording our instructions? What if it's spying on us? What if Jose Luis and I can't be trusted? More good-natured chuckles, a little warmer than before, more beery. I mean it, I said. If we were on the wrong side, this could get all of us, all of you, into a heap of trouble. Jail, maybe. The chuckles turned more nervous. So that's why I'm going to do this, I said, and picked up a hammer I'd brought from my dad's toolkit. I set the laptop down beside me on the rock and swung the hammer, Holu following the swing with his keychain light. Crash! I'd always dreamt of killing a laptop with a hammer, and here I was doing it. It felt pornographically good and bad. Smash! The screen panel fell off, shattered into millions of pieces, exposing the keyboard. I kept hitting it until the keyboard fell off, exposing the motherboard and the hard drive. Crash! I aimed square for the hard drive, hitting it with everything I had. It took 3 blows before the case split, exposing the fragile media inside. I kept hitting it until there was nothing bigger than a cigarette lighter. Then I put it all in a garbage bag. The crowd was cheering wildly, loud enough that I actually got worried that someone far above us might hear over the surf and call the law. All right, I called. Now, if you'd like to accompany me, I'm going to march this down to the sea and soak it in salt water for 10 minutes. I didn't have any takers at first, but then Ange came forward and took my arm in her warm hand and said, "That was beautiful," in my ear, and we marched down to the sea together. It was perfectly dark by the sea, and treacherous, even with our keychain lights. Slippery, sharp rocks that were difficult enough to walk on even without trying to balance 6 pounds of smashed electronics in a plastic bag. I slipped once and thought I was going to cut myself up, but Ange caught me with a surprisingly strong grip and kept me upright. I was pulled in right close to her, close enough to smell her perfume,
which smelled like new cars. I love that smell.
Thanks, I managed, looking into the big eyes that were further magnified by her mannish black-rimmed glasses. I couldn't tell what color they were in the dark, but I guessed something dark, based on her dark hair and olive complexion. She looked Mediterranean, maybe Greek, or Spanish, or Italian. I crouched down and dipped the bag in the sea, letting it fill with salt water. I managed to slip a little and soak my shoe, and I swore, and she laughed. We'd hardly said a word since we lit out for the ocean. There was something magical in our wordless silence. At that point, I had kissed a total of 3 girls in my life, not counting that moment when I went back to school and got a hero's welcome. That's not a gigantic number, but it's not a minuscule one either. I have reasonable girl radar, and I think I could have kissed her. She wasn't hot in the traditional sense, but there's something about a girl and a night and a beach. Plus, she was smart and passionate and committed. But I didn't kiss her or take her hand. Instead, we had a moment that I can only describe as spiritual. The surf, the night, the sea and the rocks, and our breathing. The moment stretched. I sighed. This had been quite a ride. I had a lot of typing to do tonight, putting all those keys into my keychain, signing them and publishing the signed keys, starting the web of trust. She sighed too. Let's go, I said. Yeah, she said. Back we went. It was a good night that night. Holu waited after for his brother's friend to come by and pick up his coolers. I walked with everyone else up the road to the nearest Muni stop and got on board. Of course, none of us was using an issued Muni pass. By that point, X-Netters habitually cloned someone else's Muni pass 3 or 4 times a day, assuming a new identity for every ride. It was hard to stay cool on the bus. We were all a little drunk, and looking at our faces under the bright bus lights was kind of hilarious. We got pretty loud, and the driver used his intercom to tell us to keep it down twice, then told us to shut up right now or he'd call the cops. That set us to giggling again, and we disembarked in a mass before he did call the cops. We are in North Beach now, and there were lots of buses, taxis, the BART at Market Street, neon-lit clubs and cafes to pull apart our grouping, so we drifted away. I got home and fired up my Xbox and started typing in keys from my phone's screen. It was dull, hypnotic work. I was a little drunk, and it lulled me into a half-sleep. I was about ready to nod off when a new IM window popped up. Hero! I didn't recognize the handle. Specs Grill. But I had an idea who might be behind it. Hi, I typed cautiously. It's me, from tonight. Then she paste-bombed a block of crypto. I'd already entered her public key into my keychain, so I told the IM client to try decrypting the code with the key. It's me from tonight.
It was her!
Fancy meeting you here, I typed, then encrypted it to my public key and mailed it off. It was great meeting you, I typed. You too. I don't meet too many smart guys who are also cute and also socially aware. Good God, man, you don't give a girl much of a chance. My heart hammered in my chest. Hello? Tap, tap? This thing on? I wasn't born here, folks, but I'm sure dying here. Don't forget to tip your waitresses. They work hard. I'm here all week. I laughed aloud. I'm here, laughing too hard to type is all. Well, at least my IM comedy foo is still mighty. It was really great to meet you, too.
Yeah, it usually is. Where are you taking me?
Taking you?
On our next adventure.
I didn't really have anything planned.
Okie, then I'll take you. Friday, Dolores Park. Illegal open-air concert. Be there or be a dodecahedron.
Wait, what?
Don't you even read XNet? It's all over the place. You ever hear of the speed whores? I nearly choked. That was Trudy Doo's band, as in Trudy Doo, the woman who had paid me in Holu to update the IndyNet code.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
They're putting on a huge show and they've got like 50 bands signed to play the bill, going to set up on the tennis courts and bring out their own amp trucks and rock out all night.
I felt like I'd been living under a rock. How had I missed that?
There was an anarchist bookstore on Valencia that I sometimes passed on the way to school that had a poster of an old revolutionary named Emma Goldman with the caption, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be a part of your revolution." I'd been spending all my energies on figuring out how to use the XNet to organize dedicated fighters so they could jam the DHS, but this was so much cooler. A big concert. I had no idea how to do one of those, but I was glad someone did. And now that I thought of it, I was damn proud that they were using the XNet to do it. The next day, I was a zombie. Ange and I had chatted, flirted, until 4 a.m. Lucky for me, it was a Saturday and I was able to sleep in, but between the hangover and the sleep debt, I could barely put two thoughts together. By lunchtime, I managed to get up and get my ass out onto the streets. I staggered down toward the Turks to buy my coffee. These days, if I was alone, I always bought my coffee there, like the Turk and I were part of a secret club. On the way, I passed a lot of fresh graffiti. I liked mission graffiti. A lot of the times it came in huge, luscious murals or sarcastic art student stencils. I liked that the mission's taggers kept right on going, under the nose of the DHS. Another kind of XNet, I supposed. They must have all kinds of ways of knowing what was going on, where to get paint, what cameras worked. Some of the cameras had been spray-painted over, I noticed. Maybe they used XNet. Painted in 10-foot-high letters on the side of an auto yard's fence were the drippy words, "Don't trust anyone over 25. I stopped. Had someone left my party last night and come here with a can of paint? A lot of those people lived in the neighborhood. I got my coffee and had a little wander around town. I kept thinking I should be calling someone, seeing if they wanted to get a movie or something. That's how it used to be on a lazy Saturday like this. But who was I going to call? Van wasn't talking to me. I didn't think I was ready to talk to Holu. And Daryl, well, I couldn't call Daryl. I got my coffee and went home and did a little searching around on the XNet's blogs. These Anana blogs were untraceable to any author, unless that author was stupid enough to put her name on it. And there were a lot of them. Most of them were apolitical, but a lot of them weren't. They talked about schools and the unfairness there. They talked about the cops, tagging. Turned out there'd been plans for the concert in the park for weeks. It had hopped from blog to blog, turning into a full-blown movement without my noticing. And the concert was called "Don't Trust Anyone Over 25. Well, that explained where Ange got it. It was a good slogan. Monday morning, I decided I wanted to check out that anarchist bookstore again, see about getting one of those Emma Goldman posters. I needed the reminder. I detoured down to 16th and Mission on my way to school, then up to Valencia and across. The store was shut, but I got the hours off the door and made sure they still had that poster up. As I walked down Valencia, I was amazed to see how much of the "Don't Trust Anyone Over 25" stuff there was. Half the shops had "Don't Trust" merch in the windows, lunchboxes, baby doll tees, pencil boxes, trucker hats. The hipster stores have been getting faster and faster, of course. As new memes sweep the net in the course of a day or two, stores have gotten better at putting merch in the windows to match. Some funny little YouTube of a guy launching himself with jetpacks made of carbonated water would land in your inbox on Monday, and by Tuesday, you'd be able to buy t-shirts with stills from the video on it. But it was amazing to see something make the leap from XNet to the head shops. Distressed designer jeans with the slogan written in careful high school ballpoint ink, embroidered patches. Good news travels fast. It was written on the blackboard when I got to Ms. Galvez's social studies class. We all sat at our desks, smiling at it. It seemed to smile back. There was something profoundly cheering about the idea that we could all trust each other, that the enemy could be identified. I knew it wasn't entirely true, but it wasn't entirely false either. Ms. Galvez came in and patted her hair and set down her schoolbook on her desk and powered it up. She picked up her chalk and turned around to face the board. We all laughed, good-naturedly, but we laughed. She turned around and was laughing too. Inflation has hit the nation's slogan writers, it seems. How many of you know where this phrase comes from? We looked at each other. Hippies? Someone said, and we laughed. Hippies are all over San Francisco, both the old stoner kinds with giant skanky beards and tie-dyes, and the new kind, who are more into dress-up and maybe playing hacky-sack than protesting anything. Well, yes, hippies. But when we think of hippies these days, we just think of the clothes and the music. Clothes and music were incidental to the main part of what made that era, the 60s, important. You've heard about the civil rights movement to end segregation, white and black kids like you riding buses into the South to sign up black voters and protest against official state racism. California was one of the main places where the civil rights leaders came from. We've always been a little more political than the rest of the country, and this is also a part of the country where black people have been able to get the same union factory jobs as white people, so they were a little better off than their cousins in the Southland. The students at Berkeley sent a steady stream of freedom riders south, and they recruited them from information tables on campus, at Bancroft and Telegraph Avenue. You've probably seen that there are still tables there to this day. Well, the campus tried to shut them down. The president of the university banned political organizing on campus, but the civil rights kids wouldn't stop. The police tried to arrest a guy who was handing out literature from one of these tables, and they put him in a van, but 3,000 students surrounded the van and refused to let it budge. They wouldn't let them take this kid to jail. They stood on top of the van and gave speeches about the First Amendment and free speech. That galvanized the free speech movement. That was the start of the hippies, but it was also where more radical student movements came from. Black power groups like the Black Panthers, and later gay rights groups like the Pink Panthers, too. Radical women's groups, even lesbian separatists who wanted to abolish men altogether. And the Yippies. Anyone ever hear of the Yippies? Didn't they levitate the Pentagon? I said. I'd once seen a documentary about this. She laughed. I forgot about that, but yes, that was them. Yippies were like very political hippies, but they weren't serious the way we think of politics these days. They were very playful, pranksters. They threw money into the New York Stock Exchange. They circled the Pentagon with hundreds of protesters and set a magic spell that was supposed to levitate it. They invented a fictional kind of LSD that you could spray onto people with squirt guns and shot each other with it and pretended to be stoned. They were funny and they made great TV. One Yippie, a clown called Wavy Gravy, used to get hundreds of protesters to dress up like Santa Claus so that the cameras would show police officers arresting and dragging away Santa on the news that night. And they mobilized a lot of people. Their big moment was the Democratic National Convention in 1968, where they called for demonstrations to protest the Vietnam War. Thousands of demonstrators poured into Chicago, slept in the parks, and picketed every day. They had lots of bizarre stunts that year, like running a pig called Pigasus for the presidential nomination. The police and the demonstrators fought in the streets. They'd done that many times before, but the Chicago cops didn't have the smarts to leave the reporters alone. They beat up the reporters, and the reporters retaliated by finally showing what really went on at these demonstrations. So the whole country watched their kids being really savagely beaten down by the Chicago police. They called it a police riot. The yippies loved to say, "Never trust anyone over 30. They meant that people who were born before a certain time, when America had been fighting enemies like the Nazis, could never understand what it meant to love your country enough to refuse to fight the Vietnamese. They thought that by the time you hit 30, your attitudes would be frozen, and you couldn't ever understand why the kids of the day were taking to the streets, dropping out, freaking out. San Francisco was ground zero for this. Revolutionary armies were founded here. Some of them blew up buildings or robbed banks for their cause. A lot of those kids grew up to be more or less normal, while others ended up in jail. Some of the university dropouts did amazing things. For example, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who founded Apple Computers and invented the PC. I was really getting into this. I knew a little of it, but I'd never heard it told like this. Or maybe it had never mattered as much as it did now. Suddenly, those lame, solemn, grown-up street demonstrations didn't seem so lame after all. Maybe there was room for that kind of action in the X-Net movement. I put my hand up. "Did they win? Did the yippies win?" She gave me a long look, like she was thinking it over. No one said a word. We all wanted to hear the answer. "They didn't lose," she said. "They kind of imploded a little. Some of them went to jail for drugs or other things. Some of them changed their tunes and became yuppies and went on the lecture circuit telling everyone how stupid they'd been, talking about how good greed was and how dumb they'd been. But they did change the world. The war in Vietnam ended, and the kind of conformity and unquestioning obedience that people had called patriotism went out of style in a big way. Black rights, women's rights, and gay rights came a long way. Chicano rights, rights for disabled people, the whole tradition of civil liberties was created or strengthened by these people. Today's protest movement is the direct descendant of those struggles." "I can't believe you're talking about them like this," Charles said. He was leaning so far out of his seat, he was half standing, and his sharp, skinny face had gone red. He had wet, large eyes and big lips, and when he got excited, he looked a little like a fish. Ms. Galvez stiffened a little, then said, "Go on, Charles." "You've just described terrorists, actual terrorists. They blew up buildings, you said. They tried to destroy the stock exchange. They beat up cops and stopped cops from arresting people who were breaking the law. They attacked us." Ms. Galvez nodded slowly. I could tell she was trying to figure out how to handle Charles, who really seemed like he was ready to pop. "Charles raises a good point. The yippies weren't foreign agents. They were American citizens. When you say they attacked us, you need to figure out who they and us are. When it's your fellow countrymen..." "Crap!" he shouted. He was on his feet now. "We were at war then. These guys were giving aid and comfort to the enemy. It's easy to tell who's us and who's them. If you support America, you're us. If you support the people who are shooting at Americans, you're them." "Does anyone else want to comment on this?" Several hands shot up. Ms. Galvez called on them. Some people pointed out that the reason that the Vietnamese were shooting at Americans is that the Americans had flown to Vietnam and started running around the jungle with guns. Others thought that Charles had a point, that people shouldn't be allowed to do illegal things. Everyone had a good debate, except Charles, who just shouted at people, interrupting them when they tried to get their points out. Ms. Galvez tried to get him to wait for his turn a couple times, but he wasn't having any of it. I was looking something up on my school book, something I knew I'd read. I found it. I stood up. Ms. Galvez looked expectantly at me. The other people followed her gaze and went quiet. Even Charles looked at me after a while, his big wet eyes burning with hatred for me. I wanted to read something, I said. It's short. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Chapter 12. Ms. Galvez's smile was wide. Does anyone know what that comes from? A bunch of people chorused. The Declaration of Independence. I nodded. Why did you read that to us, Marcus? Because it seems to me that the founders of this country said that governments should only last for so long as we believe that they're working for us. And if we stop believing in them, we should overthrow them. That's what it says, right? Charles shook his head. That was hundreds of years ago, he said. Things are different now. What's different? Well, for one thing, we don't have a king anymore. They were talking about a government that existed because some old jerk's great-great-great-grandfather believed that God put him in charge and killed everyone who disagreed with him. We have a democratically elected government. I didn't vote for them, I said. So that gives you the right to blow up a building? What? Who said anything about blowing up a building? The yippies and hippies and all those people believed that the government no longer listened to them. Look at the way people who tried to sign up voters in the South were treated. They were beaten up, arrested. Some of them were killed, Ms. Galvez said. She held up her hands and waited for Charles and me to sit down. We're almost out of time for today, but I want to commend you all on one of the most interesting classes I've ever taught. This has been an excellent discussion, and I've learned much from you all. I hope you've learned from each other, too. Thank you all for your contributions. I have an extra credit assignment for those of you who want a little challenge. I'd like you to write up a paper comparing the political response to the anti-war and civil rights movements in the Bay Area to the present-day civil rights responses to the war on terror. 3 pages minimum, but take as long as you'd like. I'm interested to see what you come up with. The bell rang a moment later, and everyone filed out of the class. I hung back and waited for Ms. Galvez to notice me. Yes, Marcus? That was amazing, I said. I never knew all that stuff about the 60s. The 70s, too. This place has always been an exciting place to live in politically charged times. I really liked your reference to the Declaration. That was very clever. Thanks, I said. It just came to me. I never really appreciated what those words all meant before today. Well, those are the words every teacher loves to hear, Marcus, she said, and shook my hand. I can't wait to read your paper. I bought the Emma Goldman poster on the way home and stuck it up over my desk, tacked over a vintage blacklight poster. I also bought a Never Trust t-shirt that had a Photoshop of Grover and Elmo kicking the grown-ups Gordon and Susan off Sesame Street. It made me laugh. I later found out that there had already been about 6 Photoshop contests for the slogan online in places like FARC and Worth 1000 and Beta, and there were hundreds of ready-made pics floating around to go on whatever merch someone churned out. Mom raised an eyebrow at the shirt, and Dad shook his head and lectured me about not looking for trouble. I felt a little vindicated by his reaction. Ange found me online again, and we IM flirted until late at night again. The white van with the antennas came back, and I switched off my Xbox until it had passed. We'd all gotten used to doing that. Van was really excited by this party. It looked like it was going to be monster. There were so many bands signed up that they were talking about setting up a B stage for the secondary acts. How'd they get a permit to blast sound all night in that park? There's houses all around there. Permit? What is permit? Tell me more of your human permit. Whoa, it's illegal? Hello? You're worried about breaking the law? Fair point. LOL. I felt a little premonition of nervousness, though. I mean, I was taking this perfectly awesome girl out on a date that weekend. Well, she was taking me, technically, to an illegal rave being held in the middle of a busy neighborhood. It was bound to be interesting, at least. Interesting. People started to drift into Dolores Park through the long Saturday afternoon, showing up among the ultimate frisbee players and the dog walkers. Some of them played frisbee or walked dogs. It wasn't really clear how the concert was going to work, but there were a lot of cops and undercovers hanging around. You could tell the undercovers because, like Zit and Booger, they had Castro haircuts and Nebraska physiques, tubby guys with short hair and untidy mustaches. They drifted around, looking awkward and uncomfortable in their giant shorts and loose-fitting shirts that no doubt hung down to cover the chandelier of gear hung around their midriffs. Dolores Park is pretty and sunny, with palm trees, tennis courts, and lots of hills and regular trees to run around on or hang out on. Homeless people sleep there at night, but that's true everywhere in San Francisco. I met Ange down the street at the Anarchist bookstore. That had been my suggestion. In hindsight, it was a totally transparent move to seem cool and edgy to this girl, but at the time I would have sworn that I picked it because it was a convenient place to meet up. She was reading a book called Up Against the Wall, Mother Effer, when I got there. Nice, I said. You kiss your mother with that mouth? Your mama don't complain, she said. Actually, it's a history of a group of people like the Yippies, but from New York. They all use that word as their last names, like Ben M.F. The idea was to have a group out there making news, but with a totally unprintable name, just to screw around with the news media. Pretty funny, really. She put the book back on the shelf, and now I wondered if I should hug her. People in California hug to say hello and goodbye all the time, except when they don't, and sometimes they kiss on the cheek. It's all very confusing. She settled it for me by grabbing me in a hug and tugging my head down to her, kissing me hard on the cheek, then blowing a fart on my neck. I laughed and pushed her away. You want a burrito? I asked. Is that a question or a statement of the obvious? Neither. It's an order. I bought some funny stickers that said, This phone is tapped, which were the right size to put on the receivers on the payphones that still lined the streets of the Mission, it being the kind of neighborhood where you got people who couldn't necessarily afford a cell phone. We walked out into the night air. I told Ange about the scene at the park when I left. I bet they have 100 of those trucks parked around the block, she said. The better to bust you with. I looked around. I sort of hoped that you would say something like, Aw, there's no chance they'll do anything about it. I don't think that's really the idea. The idea is to put a lot of civilians in a position where the cops have to decide, are we going to treat these ordinary people like terrorists? It's a little like the jamming, but with music instead of gadgets. You jam, right? Sometimes I forget that all my friends don't know that Marcus and Mikey are the same person. Yeah, a little, I said. This is like jamming with a bunch of awesome bands. I see. Mission burritos are an institution. They are cheap, giant, and delicious. Imagine a tube the size of a bazooka shell, filled with spicy grilled meat, guacamole, salsa, tomatoes, refried beans, rice, onions, and cilantro. It has the same relationship to Taco Bell that a Lamborghini has to a Hot Wheels car. There are about 200 mission burrito joints. They're all heroically ugly, with uncomfortable seats, minimal decor, faded Mexican tourist office posters, and electrified framed Jesus and Mary holograms, and loud mariachi music. The thing that distinguishes them mostly is what kind of exotic meat they fill their wares with. The really authentic places have brains and tongue, which I never order, but it's nice to know it's there. The place we went to had both brains and tongue, which we didn't order. I got carne asada, and she got shredded chicken, and we each got a big cup of horchata. As soon as we sat down, she unrolled her burrito and took a little bottle out of her purse. It was a little stainless steel aerosol canister that looked for all the world like a pepper spray self-defense unit. She aimed it at a burrito's exposed guts and misted them with a fine red oily spray. I caught a whiff of it, and my throat closed, and my eyes watered. "What the hell are you doing to that poor defenseless burrito?" She gave me a wicked smile. "I'm a spicy food addict," she said. "This is capsaicin oil in a mister."
"Capsaicin?"
"Yeah, the stuff in pepper spray. This is like pepper spray, but slightly more dilute, and way more delicious. Think of it as spicy Cajun Visine, if it helps."
My eyes burned just thinking of it. "You're kidding," I said. "You are so not going to eat that."
Her eyebrows shot up. "That sounds like a challenge, Sonny. You just watch me."
She rolled the burrito up as carefully as a stoner rolling up a joint, tucking the ends in, then rewrapping it in the tinfoil. She peeled off one end and brought it up to her mouth, poised with it just before her lips. Right up to the time she bit into it, I couldn't believe that she was going to do it. I mean, that was basically an anti-personnel weapon she'd just slathered on her dinner. She bit into it, chewed, swallowed, gave every impression of having a delicious dinner. "Want a bite?" she said innocently.
"Yeah," I said. "I like spicy food. I always order the curries with four chilies next to them on the menu at the Pakistani places." I peeled back more foil and took a big bite. Big mistake. You know that feeling you get when you take a big bite of horseradish or wasabi or whatever, and it feels like your sinuses are closing at the same time as your windpipe, filling your head with trapped nuclear hot air that tries to batter its way out through your watering eyes and nostrils? That feeling like steam is about to pour out of your ears like a cartoon character? This was a lot worse. This was like putting your hand on a hot stove, only it's not your hand, it's the entire inside of your head and your esophagus all the way down to your stomach. My entire body sprang out in a sweat, and I choked and choked. Wordlessly, she passed me my horchata, and I managed to get the straw into my mouth and suck hard on it, gulping down half of it in one go.
So there's a scale, the Scoville scale, that we chili fanciers used to talk about how spicy a pepper is. Pure capsaicin is about 15 million Scovilles. Tabasco is about 2,500. Pepper spray is a healthy 3 million. This stuff is a puny 100,000, about as hot as a mild Scotch bonnet pepper. I worked up to it in about a year. Some of the real hardcore can get up to 500,000 or so, 20 times hotter than Tabasco. That's pretty freaking hot. At Scoville temperatures like that, your brain gets totally awash in endorphins. It's a better body stone than hash, and it's good for you.
I was getting my sinuses back now, able to breathe without gasping.
Of course, you get a ferocious ring of fire when you go to the John, she said, winking at me.
Youch. You are insane, I said.
Fine talk from a man whose hobby is building and smashing laptops, she said.
Touché, I said, and touched my forehead.
Want some?
She held out her mister.
Pass, I said, quickly enough that we both laughed.
When we left the restaurant and headed for Dolores Park, she put her arm around my waist, and I found that she was just the right height for me to put my arm around her shoulders. That was new. I'd never been a tall guy, and the girls I dated had all been my height. Teenaged girls grow faster than guys, which is a cruel trick of nature. It was nice. It felt nice. We turned the corner on 20th Street and walked up toward Dolores. Before we'd taken a single step, we could feel the buzz. It was like the hum of a million bees. There were lots of people streaming toward the park, and when I looked toward it, I saw that it was about 100 times more crowded than it had been when I went to meet Ange. That sight made my blood run hot. It was a beautiful, cool night, and we were about to party, really party, party like there was no tomorrow. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Without saying anything, we both broke into a trot. There were lots of cops with tense faces, but what the hell were they going to do? There were a lot of people in the park. I'm not so good at counting crowds. The papers later quoted organizers as saying there were 20,000 people. The cops said 5,000. Maybe that means there were 12,500. Whatever. It was more people than I'd ever stood among as part of an unscheduled, unsanctioned, illegal event. We were among them in an instant. I can't swear to it, but I don't think there was anyone over 25 in that press of bodies. Everyone was smiling. Some young kids were there, 10 or 12, and that made me feel better. No one would do anything too stupid with kids that little in the crowd. No one wanted to see little kids get hurt. This was just going to be a glorious spring night of celebration. I figured the thing to do was push in toward the tennis courts. We threaded our way through the crowd, and to stay together, we took each other's hands. Only staying together didn't require us to intertwine fingers. That was strictly for pleasure. It was very pleasurable. The bands were all inside the tennis courts, with their guitars and mixers and keyboards and even a drum kit. Later, on XNet, I found a Flickr stream of them smuggling all this stuff in, piece by piece, in gym bags and under their coats. Along with it all were huge speakers, the kind you see in automotive supply places, and among them, a stack of car batteries. I laughed. Genius! That was how they were going to power their stacks. From where I stood, I could see that they were cells from a hybrid car, a Prius. Someone had gutted an eco-mobile to power the night's entertainment. The batteries continued outside the courts, stacked up against the fence, tethered to the main stack by wires threaded through the chain link. I counted 200 batteries. Christ, those things weighed a ton, too. There's no way they organized this without email and wikis and mailing lists, and there's no way people this smart would have done that on the public internet. This had all taken place on the XNet. I'd bet my boots on it. We just kind of bounced around in the crowd for a while as the bands tuned up and conferred with one another. I saw Trudy Du from a distance in the tennis courts. She looked like she was in a cage, like a pro wrestler. She was wearing a torn wife beater and her hair was in long fluorescent pink dreads down to her waist. She was wearing army camouflage pants and giant gothy boots with steel overtoes. As I watched, she picked up a heavy motorcycle jacket, as worn as a catcher's mitt, and put it on like armor. It probably was armor, I realized. I tried to wave to her, to impress Ange, I guess, but she didn't see me and I kind of looked like a spaz, so I stopped. The energy in the crowd was amazing. You hear people talk about vibes and energy for big groups of people, but until you've experienced it, you probably think it's just a figure of speech. It's not. It's the smiles, infectious and big as watermelons, on every face. Everyone bopping a little to an unheard rhythm, shoulders rocking, rolling walks, jokes and laughs. The tone of every voice tight and excited, like a firework about to go off.
and you can't help but be a part of it, because you are. By the time the bands kicked off, I was utterly stoned on crowd vibe. The opening act was some kind of Serbian turbo folk, which I couldn't figure out how to dance to. I know how to dance to exactly two kinds of music. Trance, shuffle around and let the music move you, and punk, bash around and mosh until you get hurt or exhausted, or both. The next act were Oakland hip-hoppers, backed by a thrash metal band, which is better than it sounds. Then some bubblegum pop. Then Speed Horse took the stage, and Trudy Doo stepped up to the mic. "My name is Trudy Doo, and you're an idiot if you trust me. I'm 32, and it's too late for me. I'm lost. I'm stuck in the old way of thinking. I still take my freedom for granted and let other people take it away from me. You're the first generation to grow up in Gulag America, and you know what your freedom is worth to the last goddamn cent." The crowd roared. She was playing fast little skittery nervous chords on her guitar, and her bass player, a huge fat girl with a dykey haircut and even bigger boots and a smile you could open beer bottles with, was laying it down fast and hard already. I wanted to bounce. I bounced. Ange bounced with me. We were sweating freely in the evening, which reeked of perspiration and pot smoke, warm bodies crushed in on all sides of us. They bounced, too. "Don't trust anyone over 25, she shouted. We roared. We were one big animal throat, roaring. "Don't trust anyone over 25. Don't 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 trust anyone over 25. She banged some hard chords on her guitar, and the other guitarist, a little pixie of a girl whose face bristled with piercings, jammed in, going wheedledee, wheedledee-dee up high past the 12th fret. "It's our goddamn city. It's our goddamn country. No terrorist can take it from us for so long as we're free. Once we're not free, the terrorists win. Take it back. Take it back. You're young enough and stupid enough not to know that you can't possibly win. So you're the only ones who can lead us to victory. Take it back. Take it back," we roared. She jammed down hard on her guitar. We roared the note back, and then it got really, really loud. I danced until I was so tired I couldn't dance another step. Ange danced alongside me. Technically, we were rubbing our sweaty bodies against each other for several hours, but believe it or not, I totally wasn't being a horn dog about it. We were dancing, lost in the godbeat and the thrash and the screaming, "Take it back! Take it back!" When I couldn't dance anymore, I grabbed her hand and she squeezed mine like I was keeping her from falling off a building. She dragged me toward the edge of the crowd, where it got thinner and cooler. Out there, on the edge of Dolores Park, we were in the cool air and the sweat on our bodies went instantly icy. We shivered and she threw her arms around my waist. "Warm me," she commanded. I didn't need a hint. I hugged her back. Her heart was an echo of the fast beats from the stage. Breakbeats now, fast and furious and wordless. She smelled of sweat, a sharp tang that smelled great. I knew I smelled of sweat, too. My nose was pointed into the top of her head, and her face was right at my collarbone. She moved her hands to my neck and tugged. "Get down here. I didn't bring a stepladder," is what she said. And I tried to smile, but it's hard to smile when you're kissing. Like I said, I'd kissed three girls in my life. Two of them had never kissed anyone before. One had been dating since she was 12. She had issues. None of them kissed like Ange. She made her whole mouth soft, like the inside of a ripe piece of fruit. And she didn't jam her tongue in my mouth, but slid it in there. and sucked my lips into her mouth at the same time, so it was like my mouth and hers were merging. I heard myself moan, and I grabbed her and squeezed her harder. Slowly, gently, we lowered ourselves to the grass. We lay on our sides and clutched each other, kissing and kissing. The world disappeared, so there was only the kiss. My hands found her butt, her waist, the edge of her t-shirt, her warm tummy, her soft navel. They inched higher. She moaned too.
"Not here," she said. "Let's move over there."
She pointed across the street at the big white church that gives Mission Dolores Park and the mission its name. Holding hands, moving quickly, we crossed to the church. It had big pillars in front of it. She put my back up against one of them and pulled my face down to hers again. My hands went quickly and boldly back to her shirt. I slipped them up her front.
"It undoes in the back," she whispered into my mouth.
I had a boner that could cut glass. I moved my hands around to her back, which was strong and broad, and found the hook with my fingers, which were trembling. I fumbled for a while, thinking of all those jokes about how bad guys are at undoing bras. I was bad at it. Then the hook sprang free. She gasped into my mouth. I slipped my hands around, feeling the wetness of her armpits, which was sexy and not at all gross for some reason, and then brushed the sides of her breasts. That's when the siren started. They were louder than anything I'd ever heard, a sound like a physical sensation, like something blowing you off your feet, a sound as loud as your ears could process, and then louder.
"Disperse immediately,"
a voice said, like God rattling in my skull.
"This is an illegal gathering. Disperse immediately."
The band had stopped playing. The noise of the crowd across the street changed. It got scared, angry. I heard a click as the PA system of car speakers and car batteries in the tennis courts powered up.
"Take it back!"
It was a defiant yell, like a sound shouted into the surf or screamed off a cliff.
"Take it back!"
The crowd growled, a sound that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
"Take it back!"
they chanted.
"Take it back! Take it back! Take it back!"
The police moved in lines, carrying plastic shields, wearing Darth Vader helmets that covered their faces. Each one had a black truncheon and infrared goggles. They looked like soldiers out of some futuristic war movie. They took a step forward in unison, and every one of them banged his truncheon on his shield, a cracking noise like the earth splitting. Another step, another crack. They were all around the park and closing in now.
"Disperse immediately,"
the voice of God said again. There were helicopters overhead now. No floodlights, though. The infrared goggles, right, of course. They'd have infrared scopes in the sky, too. I pulled Ange back against the doorway of the church, tucking us back from the cops and the choppers.
"Take it back!"
the PA roared. It was Trudy Dew's rebel yell, and I heard her guitar thrash out some chords, then her drummer playing, then that big, deep bass.
"Take it back!"
the crowd answered, and they boiled out of the park at the police lines. I've never been in a war, but now I think I know what it must be like. What it must be like when scared kids charge across a field at an opposing force, knowing what's coming, running anyway, screaming, hollering.
"Disperse immediately,"
the voice of God said. It was coming from trucks parked all around the park, trucks that had swung into place in the last few seconds. That's when the mist fell. It came out of the choppers, and we just caught the edge of it. It made the top of my head feel like it was going to come off. It made my sinuses feel like they were being punctured with ice picks. It made my eyes swell and water, and my throat close. Pepper spray.
Not 100,000 Scovilles. 1.5 million. They'd gassed the crowd. I didn't see what happened next, but I heard it, over the sound of both me and Ange choking and holding each other. First the choking, retching sounds. The guitar and drums and bass crashed to a halt. Then coughing. Then screaming. The screaming went on for a long time. When I could see again, the cops had their scopes up on their foreheads, and the choppers were flooding Dolores Park with so much light it looked like daylight. Everyone was looking at the park, which was good news, because when the lights went up like that, we were totally visible.
"What do we do?"
Ange said. Her voice was tight, scared. I didn't trust myself to speak for a moment. I swallowed a few times. "We walk away," I said. "That's all we can do, walk away, like we were just passing by. Down to Dolores and turn left and up toward 16th Street, like we were just passing by, like this is none of our business."
"That'll never work," she said.
"It's all I've got."
"You don't think we should try to run for it?"
"No," I said. "If we run, they'll chase us. Maybe if we walk, they'll figure we haven't done anything and let us alone. They have a lot of arrests to make. They'll be busy for a long time." The park was rolling with bodies, people and adults clawing at their faces and gasping. The cops dragged them by the armpits, then lashed their wrists with plastic cuffs and tossed them into the trucks like rag dolls. "Okay," I said.
"Okay,"
she said. And that's just what we did. Walked, holding hands, quickly and businesslike, like two people wanting to avoid whatever trouble someone else was making. The kind of walk you adopt when you want to pretend you can't see a panhandler or don't want to get involved in a street fight. It worked. We reached the corner and turned and kept going. Neither of us dared to speak for two blocks. Then I let out a gasp of air I hadn't known I'd been holding in. We came to 16th Street and turned down toward Mission Street. Normally, that's a pretty scary neighborhood at 2 a.m. on a Saturday night. That night, it was a relief. Same old druggies and hookers and dealers and drunks. No cops with truncheons. No gas. I said, as we breathed in the night air. "Coffee?"
"Home," she said.
"I think home for now. Coffee later."
"Yeah," I agreed. She lived up in Hayes Valley. I spotted a taxi rolling by and I hailed it. That was a small miracle. There are hardly any cabs when you need them in San Francisco. "Have you got cab fare home?"
"Yeah,"
she said. The cab driver looked at us through his window. I opened the back door so he wouldn't take off. "Good night," I said. She put her hands behind my head and pulled my face toward her. She kissed me hard on the mouth, nothing sexual in it, but somehow more intimate for that.
"Good night,"
she whispered in my ear, and slipped into the taxi. Head swimming, eyes running, a burning shame for having left all those ex-netters to the tender mercies of the DHS and the SFPD, I set off for home. Monday morning, Fred Benson was standing behind Ms. Galvez's desk.
"Ms. Galvez will no longer be teaching this class," he said, once we'd taken our seats.
His voice had a self-satisfied note that I recognized immediately. On a hunch, I checked out Charles. He was smiling like it was his birthday and he'd been given the best present in the world. I put my hand up.
"Why not?"
"It's board policy not to discuss employee matters with anyone except the employee and the disciplinary committee," he said,
without even bothering to hide how much he enjoyed saying it.
"We'll be beginning a new unit today, on national security. Your school books have the new texts. Please open them and turn to the first screen."
The opening screen was emblazoned with a DHS logo and the title, "What Every American Should Know About Homeland Security." I wanted to throw my schoolbook on the floor. I'd made arrangements to meet Ange at a cafe in her neighborhood after school. I jumped on the BART and found myself sitting behind two guys in suits. They were looking at the San Francisco Chronicle, which featured a full-page postmortem on the youth riot in Mission Dolores Park. They were tutting and clucking over it. Then one said to the other,
"It's like they're brainwashed or something. Christ, were we ever that stupid?"
I got up and moved to another seat.